This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hello, Man fans. Ollie Mann here with The Modern Man. Thank you for all your grateful reactions to our return. It makes us feel very special. Kate, for example, says, Ollie, I can't tell you how delighted I was to see The Modern Man when I opened up my podcast app for my morning cycle. Thank you for accompanying me on my travels again. A pleasure, Kate. It's an absolute pleasure. But do keep one ear out for traffic, won't you? And Stephanie says, thank you, Ollies, for the section last week on deleting your social media account. I deleted my Facebook about a year and a half ago, and I went Instagram free about 2 months ago. I'm happier, get more sleep, have more free time, and deeper meaningful relationships with the people around me who I actually like, instead of fake relationships with strangers. To keep in touch with friends and family, I now use Slack groups, or I just pick up the phone and actually talk to them. Interesting. Thank you, Stephanie. Although I must say, if you are to head to facebook.com/Ollie Mann right now, you will see the astonishing artwork submitted to us by our ambassador for St. Leonard's-on-Sea, Danny. Now, you may recall last week, Danny requested to be our artist in residence, as well as our ambassador. And my response was, well, I haven't seen your work, so it's a bit hard to bestow that particular honour upon you. But anyway, he has now sent us an impressionistic portrait that he's done of myself, Ollie, and Alex, and it's amazing. It looks great. We don't have faces in it, which sounds creepy, but isn't somehow. And apparently the reason is Danny has prosopagnosia, which is basically facial blindness. So he draws people by the way they move, not their faces. So he drew us by finding a video of us on YouTube. We were talking about a vibrator in it, obviously. And he sketched us from that. Anyway, it's really good. Check it out at facebook.com/Ollie Mann. And Danny, yes, you can now consider yourself our artist in residence. Congratulations. Now, on today's show, you will learn how you can still feel in control when you're 35,000 feet up in the air. You will learn how a bottle of mineral water can help you survive turbulence. And you'll learn why you might not want surfactant in your lubricant. Right, let's go. On this week's Modern Man.
They directly fly into turbulence. They go straight through the clouds, through everything. They're not bothered.
Claustrophobia, panic attacks, and the unremarkable truth. How to cure your fear of flight.
Even Shakespeare referred to open-ass fruit.
And it's poetry in motion as Alex Fox considers lubrication for conception. But first, it's time to talk trends with a man who's literally just eaten a slice of tomato and a slice of nectarine and seems content to call that a salad. It's Ollie Peart.
It is definitely a salad.
Because you spent, what, £7 on it, which is obviously a rip-off.
It was £9, actually.
Anyway, was it really? For a salad? Jesus.
It was. It's good, though. It's nice, the bit I had so far.
You have just flown back from Prague, as discussed last week. How was Hamleys?
It's all like those blokes throwing those planes around,
yeah,
catching them, all that stuff. Yeah, yeah.
People blowing outside. Bubbles at you.
Exactly.
Okay.
All that's going on. Great.
Good. But we're not here to talk about toy shops of the world.
No.
We are here to do the Zeitgeist. You were in Prague, Ollie, to investigate the latest VR tech.
Yep.
What did you learn?
So I went to go and see Europe's largest virtual reality experience, and it's basically a game called Gollum. They'd built it in a physical space. So they built what looked like, when you take the mask off, a giant rat's maze that you'd find in a lab, you know, for like testing, I don't know, cures for herpes or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it was completely black. Everything was painted black. But what they'd done, they had loads of sensors everywhere, and you were wearing an Oculus Rift mask. They got 28 headsets, and 28 people can play the game simultaneously, but only 4 in each game. And I found that really fascinating, because even if though it's in a small space, it works like a game of golf. But if you were with a kid that couldn't figure out that a shape looked like the shape they were asking you to get, then it would just hold you up before you moved on.
And is the idea that you don't all then walk into each other, is that why there's a limit on how many people are in the room?
No, not at all. It's just the capacity of the game, because it requires a huge amount of processing power. So what it's doing is, it's not like VR that you'd wear at home, where you just put it on and you sit down and you're just in one space. Mm. You can walk around it. You can physically walk around it. So it's mapped the walls, and you literally walk into 16th century Prague, and you can look through windows. The walls are walls, which they aren't in virtual reality. So it's like, you know, you can touch a wall, you can knock on a door, you can look through a window.
And you can hurt yourself, presumably.
Well, no, because there's walls in here. You're not walking into the walls, are you?
But I'm not blindfolded, being encouraged to.
But you're not, because everything you're seeing has been mapped, including the people that you're playing with.
I see. So unless you chose to walk into a wall, that's the real wall.
Yeah, exactly. On the front of the mask was a thing called Elite Motion, which you don't get on the consumer versions. You can buy them, but you have to know what you're doing to attach it to it. And what that does is it digitally maps your hand. So as you move your hand, you don't need to wear a glove or anything like that. You can see it in virtual reality. And they encourage you, when you're in there, to high-five with other people.
So, okay, so you played a game, mm-hmm. It was good.
Yes.
What else did you learn?
Well, after I got back, I found out that Oculus were releasing the Oculus Go, which is the first sort of real attempt at a standalone virtual reality headset.
Because the others have to be tethered into a PlayStation or whatever.
Tethered into a PlayStation or a computer, or, like, the Samsung Gear
VR.
Yeah,
well, you
stick your phone on it.
Yeah.
And I have one.
Fuck off. You've actually brought one here. I said bring me an Oculus and you've brought me... Am I going to try Oculus Rift now? Except it's not called Oculus Rift anymore.
You're not, no, it's called Oculus Go.
I'm going to try Oculus Go.
Yeah.
Wow, well done.
Thank you very much.
I mean, obviously, like, I'm now going to have to say, this is a bit rubbish when I put it on. But actually... No, I do, because that's like the part we've for ourselves now.
No.
Yeah, you're the monkey, I'm Clarkson. We know how it works. But what I'm saying is, congratulations on passing the test.
Well, thanks very much.
Okay.
So here it is.
Yeah. It is a grey plastic box that actually, see, now, right now, immediately I'm being cynical, even though I'm grateful that you brought me it, I think looks unexciting and a bit like the kind of thing you'd have seen at the Ideal Home Show 10 years ago with some guy saying, it's the future, and you thinking, no, it isn't.
Well, maybe that's a good thing, because it's pretty inconspicuous. It's
I bet it's really expensive, though.
How much do you think it is?
Well, because it's Oculus, I'm going to say £1,200, although it shouldn't be. It should be £399.
It's £199.
Okay, fair enough, because it looks like it's worth about that.
If you put it on first, maybe take your headphones off.
Never.
No, because if you take them off and then I'll put your headphones on over the top. That's the first time Ollie's ever taken his headphones off. He lives with them on. In your hand, I'm going to put the controller. I should probably take the spoken to you about this before I put
before
the mask on.
Before you thrust something into my hand.
And it works
put
like
a stiff object into my thumb.
It works like a gun, kind of a bit like a laser pointer. Mm-hmm. And you pull the trigger to click and then you press the button down. Oh, we'll sort it out in a minute. I'm going to turn it on.
Okay.
Here we go. So I'm pressing the on button.
Yep.
And you'll just
see... I see the Oculus logo.
The Oculus logo.
I'm excited because it really is Oculus, not a Samsung phone strapped into a plastic thing.
No, this is the, you know, the real deal. And £199, they're trying to make people...
When are they coming out?
They came out on Tuesday.
Oh, right.
Tuesday the 26th, so they're available now. You can buy them now. So what can you see now? Like, what's it saying?
I can see a menu. Ah!
Oh, are you dangling over a cliff?
Yes.
Yes. How do you feel?
I feel alive. For the first time ever in my life, I feel truly alive. No, I mean, I feel like I can see around me the Grand Canyon, and in front of me, I can see a menu... That looks almost like on a Roku smart TV dongle, if you've got one of those, like a menu of different options, including Netflix and Showtime, bizarrely.
That's a good start. So I want to show you Netflix first. Just imagine you're in a busy airport and you're like, oh, I just need a bit of space. You in Netflix?
Oh, okay. So it's quite clever. They've done it so that it feels like I'm in...
Well, look to your left.
Oh, nice, yeah. So I've got literally a mountain view. I don't know if that's a reference to Silicon Valley. And it feels like I'm in a kind of ski hut, almost, like a sort of après ski.
It's a chalet.
Environment. Yes, it's a chalet. That's
you're
the
in a chalet.
For. I'm in a chalet.
That's where you are.
Yeah. And I'm watching an enormous telly in front of me, although it does say, your device may not be connected to the internet. Please make sure your connection is working. Try again.
Yeah, because you're not connected
Because I'm not connected
to the internet.
No, but I get the idea. Yeah, it's a nice environment to watch Netflix, I guess.
What? Okay, I thought you'd be a little bit more sort of overwhelmed by that. That astonished me.
But I'd be conscious of how I actually looked in the real world, sitting in an airport lounge with this on my head like a dick. I can't see people mocking me and taking my photograph.
I'm definitely not swearing at you.
Right.
Okay, so that's just home entertainment.
My eyes are getting a bit steamy.
Yeah, it does do that, actually.
Yeah.
Now we're going to try a roller coaster.
Okay. Oh! There's a sound in my ears that said, welcome to Relix Coaster. Where's the sound coming from? Has it got built-in headphones?
It's got built-in speakers, but they sort of surround you. So
yeah, they're really good.
It feels like it's kind of going through your head.
Okay, it says, hold tight to your seatbelts because you'll fly.
Ooh.
Oh, I'm being strapped in.
Now tell me the sensations.
Okay, now I feel, oh God, I actually feel it in my stomach, yeah.
You're feeling a bit pukey.
I did just feel a bit pukey, just like the real thing. Oh, I just had a rock fall on my head.
I think this bit is quite slow.
Yeah.
I'm going to move that cup of water because you almost knocked it over.
Right, yeah, well, you see, this is the danger with VR, isn't it? I do not know what's happening to me in the real world.
No, if I was sat in an airport, I'm not doing a roller coaster because I'd look like an absolute tit.
Right.
But if I was watching Netflix, that's okay, fine.
Sorry, I'm just about to go down an epic drop.
Oh, here we go.
Oh, my God, yeah, it really is the feeling of going fast on a roller coaster. Whoa, God. Oh, I feel dizzy and sick, yeah, just like the real thing. Oh my God, yeah. Oh God.
It's actually
really like the real thing.
I heard a bit of it come up in your throat then.
Oh, okay. So they've done it very well. It still looks like computer graphics though.
Yeah, sure.
And they look like good computer graphics.
You can tell it's a virtual space, right? It's not photorealistic.
Exactly.
No.
You can't see my own legs though, which is weird. Just an empty seat when I look down to my own lap. I mean, I'm looking at an empty seat, which makes me feel hollow, which is sort of strange. Take this off my head because I am feeling a bit sick now.
How do you feel?
A bit like after a roller coaster, a bit adrenalised and shaky, yeah.
You'll probably feel like that for a good 20 minutes.
Right.
I felt like that for a fair old while after that. You do look a bit
peaky. Yeah, exactly.
I'm not convinced, actually, that that's the kind of thing that's going to kick off in virtual reality. Because if you're sat at home, there's only so many times you're going to want to sit on a roller coaster. Where I think they'll really do well, I guess, is one for watching Netflix because it's a really nice environment.
Yeah, but what's it going to do to your eyes, man? You've got that screen right next to your eyes. I don't want to watch an hour-long program like that.
There is that.
I mean, you wouldn't sit next to a TV like that, would you? Iris on cathode ray action.
I guess you're not that far away from it. A laptop screen, it's not that much further than a laptop screen, but even so, yeah, it can't be great.
This device, as you say, is £199. Mm-hmm. That is kind of, when we've been cynical about VR for the last 4 years, mm-hmm. it's because the devices cost four times as much as that. But this is now getting to a stage where it is worth a punt for a bit of fun. I could afford £200 that I don't really need to spend on something I don't really need, whereas I couldn't afford £600. So I could imagine getting one, mm-hmm. but really, isn't it just going to gather dust in a drawer like my Kindle did?
The best thing about that isn't the experiences, it's about going places that you wouldn't necessarily be able to go, or seeing things that you wouldn't be able to necessarily see. And what I mean by that are things like live events. So there's an app called Melody VR, mm-hmm. Which is backed by, I think, Warner Music, a load of other people. And you can basically be right on the stage, you can pick from different locations at live music events. And then you can watch them afterwards and pay to watch them. It's just sort of, you know, if you're really into your live music and you can't get there for whatever reason, that's a good thing. But I think social media. There's a social app on there called AltSpace, and it creates environments where you can go in and you can physically chat to people. I say physically, sort of in telepresence, if you want to call it. Mm-hmm. And you go in and you say, oh, hello, my name's Ollie. You're right.
And can you see them? What
you
are you
see
looking
their avatars.
At? You're seeing their avatar.
Yeah, which you can design. So you can design your own avatar. Same, like, you know, the Wii's had avatars for ages. Mm. It's kind of that kind of style thing. And those virtual spaces, I mean, they're, you know, again, not photorealistic. There's one called The Campfire. You just all stand around the campfire and there's a discussion board and you can just chat about what's on the discussion board. But what's nice about it with this headset is that as you walk past people, the sound is in like a, I guess, you, I don't know what you'd call it, I guess sort of like 360 audio. As you sort of go towards them, it gets louder and louder. So you can't hear conversations happening over the other side of the space, but as you stand next to someone, you can hear what they're saying, so you can converse with them directly.
And of course, Oculus is owned by Facebook, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
So if you're pro-Oculus and pro-Campfire, are you now pro-social media, having last week said that we should all delete our accounts?
No. I think that virtual reality opens up an interesting difference between your social media feed and its type of sort of social media, in that you can go in and have a proper discussion.
One of the good things, of course, about Ollie not being on Twitter is that if you have a challenge for him to do on the show, you can at-reply him into it and he won't see it, so we can discuss his foibles publicly. And our challenge for you this week is from manfan Nicola, mm-hmm. who says, I would like to invite Ollie to try a gong bath.
What?
Any ideas at all?
Well, I know what a gong is, and I know what a bath is.
Yeah.
Combination of the two
implies
to me that it's an upside-down gong with water in it, and I sit in it.
It's a genuine trend, and that doesn't sound like a... I mean, I know spa trends are a bit faddy, but that really doesn't sound like one. Is Try it? Harder. What's a gong?
A gong is a massive... are they bronze? I don't know. Maybe I'll find this out.
Mm-hmm.
I think they're bronze things that you hit and it makes a...
Yes, exactly. So
and lets you know dinner's ready.
What would you say was the fundamental part of that experience?
The sound.
Yes, the sound. Right, okay. What do you know about baths?
That they immerse you.
Yes.
Oh, I'm getting there.
We're getting there, yeah.
Right, okay.
Okay, so what do you think a gong bath might be? It's a genuine trend.
A sound immersion.
Sound immersion what?
Gongs.
Therapy was the word I was looking for.
Oh, right. Oh, therapy. I wouldn't have... No, because...
That's right, Ollie. Oh. In 2 minutes' time, a cab is arriving right here to take you for your first ever sound immersion therapy in South London.
In 2 minutes?
Yep.
Brilliant.
Enjoy. We all look forward to hearing about your experiences next week and perhaps seeing them in virtual reality.
Hello, Man fans. My name is Dr. Jessica Barker, and I'm a co-founder of Redacted Firm. Today, I'm giving my top three life hacks for how to stay safe online. My first tip is to protect your passwords. It's important to have complicated passwords, and the reason you need a different password for each account is that if your password gets breached, which happens quite a lot, then that can expose all of your other accounts if you're reusing it. So what we increasingly recommend in cybersecurity is to have a password manager, which is basically like a vault. You then just need to remember one long, complicated password, make it a good one, and then store all of your other passwords in the vault, in the password manager. The top three recommended password managers tend to be KeePass, 1Password, and Dashlane. My second tip is to use two-factor authentication. Two-factor authentication means that you aren't just relying on your passwords to keep your account safe. When you yourself go to log into your account from a device that isn't the one you normally use, you'll be prompted to put in a code that is sent by text message usually to your mobile phone. So if someone doesn't have your mobile phone, they can't get into your account even if they have your password. That may sound like a lot of hassle, but it actually is really simple and easy to use. And once you've set it up, it will just keep working for your accounts. There is a great website called TurnOn2FA, and that has really simple guidelines for each service, each website, how you set up 2FA. My final tip is to be wary of public Wi-Fi. You are relying on the security of that network, and you're relying that the network that presents itself as a coffee shop or hotel network, that it is a legitimate one. What can happen is that cyber criminals can set up a network, they can make it look like a legitimate one, and so you may actually not be connecting to the network you think you are. This means any information you're sending over that Wi-Fi could be compromised. So try not to do online banking, try not to make purchases, try not to use your social media when you're on public Wi-Fi. So those are my top three tips for staying safe online. For more information about cybersecurity, you can go to redactedfirm.com and you can check out cyber.uk/protect for more top tips.
Thanks to Jessica for her life hack, sponsored by Podcast Lounge for Windows. Podcast Lounge is the new podcatcher for Windows 10 devices. It's an app where you can discover, subscribe, and enjoy podcasts. Now introducing Smart Playlists, where you can queue up all the new episodes across all your favourites from the last week with a single click. Or thud, if you're using a touchscreen, you get the idea. What will you get up to in the lounge? Go to Windows 10 Store and download your free trial of Podcast Lounge now.
Now, with the summer holidays just around the corner, are you salivating at the prospect of a fortnight of sun and sangria, or are you petrified because you have to get on a plane to get there? For so many people, that is the reality. They might still travel, but they're so nervous about flying, it actually causes them anxiety for months ahead of their holiday and even during the break itself. Anna P is a team leader on Virgin Atlantic's Fear of Flying course. They help up to 3,000 people per year overcome aviophobia and claim a 98% success rate. Anticipating that Anna must have had a lifelong interest in aviation, when I started our interview, I simply asked her to recall her first flight and expected a geeky answer about aircraft. But instead, she said this.
My mum booked us to Berlin or Frankfurt somewhere on a massive sort of Pan Am, big jumbo jet arrived. And I was always like a nervous sort of child anyway, a bit nervy, not very confident. And this massive thing arrived and got in. And doors hadn't even closed, and I'd gone completely just nuts. That's the only way I can sort of explain it. Anxiety, panic attacks, everything.
How old were you?
Must have been about 17.
But when you carried away with the excitement of getting on the plane, what changed when the doors closed?
No, I wasn't excited at all, because my dad was actually pissed. I think he passed the fear on to me. He'd never flown, and he'd always talk about crashes and things, what he'd read in the paper. So I think that had been fed into me over the years. And I had nothing positive about planes. It was just hideous. And I got in and panic attacks. But the sort of cabin crew weren't that bothered in those days. Just like... said to my mum, just shut her up, you know.
So what form did the panic attack take?
Sweating. I didn't even know. I thought I was having a heart attack. But at that age, you know, 17, it was just irrational. I was sweating. Heart was racing. I just wanted to get out. And then they closed the doors and it took off. And just, that's it. I actually thought I was dying. Cold sweats. I got hot. And I couldn't cry. I was just sat in the seat, dug my hands in it, had no nails left, nothing. And for an hour, I think it was to Frankfurt, an hour or so, it was just sheer panic. I thought I was dying for that whole hour.
And was there any support available? Because this is kind of pre-internet as well, isn't it? So
this
now
is pre-internet. So there's nothing. There was a book, I remember someone told me there's one book that somebody had written, Self-Help for Your Nerves, but I couldn't get it in Germany. So there was nothing, no Valiums, nothing back then.
Would you go as far to say that sort of ruined your holiday then?
Totally. That's all I didn't sleep. That's all I thought about, was getting back on that sort of tube, you know, coughing on wings, as I like to call it.
Because that's interesting, because I was always a bit scared of flying as a kid. But I would say that the holiday made it worthwhile. I'd justify it by saying, yeah, but I got to go to Disneyland.
Because I've nearly just died. I've had this sort of, I didn't know I was having a panic attack back then. I thought it was some sort of a heart attack thing going on. So I thought, right, I'm getting back onto this thing. I'm going to die again. And reluctantly, my mum sort of booted me up the sort of stairs again. It was this massive Pan Am Boeing thing. And back to sort of Heathrow. But because I knew we were going home, we're going to land, it was a bit better.
But it was an ordeal.
Audio wouldn't even explain it. It was just something that really shook me up for the next, I'd say, 18 years.
Did you get back on a plane in that time?
No. And absolutely nothing would actually get me onto a plane. Nothing at all. So for 18 years after that experience, that was it.
Okay, so how did you come to do what you're doing now then?
I sort of worked in sort of stand-up comedy world and also as a photographer, and I missed a lot of contracts, and I missed out on work, and for holidays I had to travel, or for just work, I had to travel to Germany, Russia, on my own with trains. So
you were like Kate Bush?
God, absolutely. It was crazy, like 6-7 connections on my own, having to travel with all my stuff. And that was for about 16 years, and nothing would get me back onto a plane. You could put all the money in the world next to me, not interested. I would not get on. I wouldn't even do a half an hour, 20-minute flight, not interested. And when I got to Cologne, this was, I think, in 2000, something like that, 2002, and I fainted with all my kit and sparked out on sort of a station concourse, taken by German ambulance, dehydrated. And that, I think that's what changed my mind. I've got to address this, because I'm losing out. I'm sort of put myself at risk. I'm not having a good time. And so that was the sort of point when I said, I've got to address this.
How did you address that then?
So I'd heard about courses and things, and somebody pointed me in the direction of sort of Virgin. And
what does the course involve, or what did it involve then?
Back then it was in the 90s, and it was actually held in a mock-up aircraft back in Virgin's base. And the guys, actually, they were brilliant. They instilled a lot of confidence. But we were in this mock-up, and I knew I was in a mock-up, and I could actually leave. There's a room there, there's a door, I'm out. It didn't convince me that I was okay. They teach you all the sort of basics about the plane. They get a captain in who tells you all the noises. You could ask him any question going, technical stuff and not so technical stuff.
What did you want to know?
Probably just what you're going to do if I get a panic attack. And they'll go, simply, we'll just talk you out of it, give you a bit of oxygen, that's about it, and teach you some relaxation. But I knew that I wasn't in a real plane, so I wasn't convinced.
But teach you some relaxation, that seems like the kind of thing you can fob someone off with.
Mm.
Is that something that air stewards are taught?
they're actually nowadays they can deliver babies and so that everything that they're that I if somebody sort of calls them a trolley doll in front of me, and I'll get really angry now because I know that they do a lot more than that. They're trained to deal like with everything, and they are highly skilled.
Okay, so you knew you were on a mock up.
Yep. So I knew the different. Door's there. Yep. Yeah. The door's there. I know I'm going to get out. So
did you book yourself onto a real flight?
No. So because I wasn't convinced, so I let it brew for another 2 years. I went back to Virgin. I actually spoke to the guys on the phone that run it, and they said, well, now we do a course with a flight now, so it's much longer. It's about a 10-hour day. And okay, I booked myself onto it because I think that incident in Cologne where I sort of passed out, that I didn't want that to happen again. And then,
and how did you feel knowing that the day was going to end with a flight?
I was absolutely bricking myself. It was horrific. But I could see there's 100-odd people with me going through the same thing. Some were worse even. I didn't think it would be possible to get worse than me.
What did the people who were worse look like?
Probably very white or very red and crying and really distressed.
Even at the end of the course, after they'd had all the psychology?
Still, there were some people. I think for some it works differently for other people. Some people, you know, like me, I could hide it well. Some people were sort of like, I wish I was the one that could have let it out, just let it out with the tears, but I couldn't. But then I got to the top of the to the aircraft on the stairs, and I thought, I'm not getting on, just not getting on. I've just spent £200 on this, I'm not getting on. And Paul Tizard, who runs the course, sort of said, that's fine, you've got as far as getting up onto a plane again, you've done all right, let's go back and get a coffee. And then something sort of flipped in my head and just went, right, no. I've got to do this. It's get on. We had a running commentary from a captain. Every single noise that the plane made, the wheels going up,
even during takeoff.
During takeoff, the whole flight was commentary, live commentary.
Where did they fly you to? You just went
it
around
was Luton to Luton. Well, so gorgeous,
the most glamorous of
absolutely.
All flight paths.
I wanted to fly just to get out of there. It took off, and I had no feelings of anxiety at all. Nothing. Different type of feelings, more of excitement now.
Okay, so I want to talk to you obviously about what you tell people now, but at the time, what was the thing that had really worked for you?
Even though I'm 35,000 feet up, I'm still in control of myself. I now know all the technical side of flying, all the noises. Don't look at the cabin crew because they look a bit nervous. They're probably just gossiping about somebody. Something flipped in my head, said it's okay.
Okay, and how did you go from that to doing what you do now professionally?
After the course, I made sure I flew a lot, so I made up for a lot of lost time.
Did you go transatlantic?
Not at that time, I didn't, but yeah, afterwards I did. And then the guys actually got in touch with me from Virgin and said, look, because of your personality and your background, and you're probably one of the most frightened people that we've come across ever, and you've managed to get over it completely, would you sort of be able to come and sort of work with us?
What a bizarre recruitment process.
I know.
And so did you think, yes, I want to help other people who are like me, scared when they get on the plane? Or did you think, yeah, but I'm going to have to spend a lot more time on planes now and I still don't love it?
Well, that's it. I did love it. I am even subscribed to sort of like Airliner World magazine, which is a really bad, sad thing. So I went from absolutely hating this thing, not ever getting on a plane in my life, to loving it.
Okay, Anna, I want to introduce you to Rebecca. Rebecca is a colleague of mine from another podcast I do called The Week Unwrapped, and she's a journalist. And Rebecca, perhaps you could share your attitude to flying.
Well, I mean, I started being afraid of flying when I was about 10, and I had flown before then. I flew when I was about 4 and maybe one time after that. Mm-hmm. I just remember sitting in Gatwick Airport. I had a triple bill of Ina Blyton, and I remember looking at it just thinking, I don't want to get on this flight. I don't know why, I just really don't want to. And then it became this whole thing where anytime we would go on holiday, we'd maybe go abroad like every other year when I was growing up. And it would become this whole thing where my parents didn't want to tell me, and then they would sort of break the news to me that we were going on holiday, which is the most ridiculous thing in retrospect. But much like you were saying, I would, you know, it would almost be like I'd be having a good time on holiday, and then it would be like when you catch yourself having fun at a wake. There would be a moment where you think, oh, this isn't appropriate. Yeah. You know, I think, I have to get back on a plane after all of this. Like, why am I giggling by the pool?
Talk us through what you were actually thinking when you were on that plane.
Well, I continued to fly, you know, on family holidays amid much drama. 18 was the last time I flew for about 8 years. I went with my friend, and when we were in sixth form, we went to Rome together. Mm-hmm. And to me, I mean, maybe I'm not like the usual case, because I'm usually actually okay in takeoff and landing. I actually mm-hmm. get really relieved as soon as we start heading towards the ground, even though I know that you'd be just as dead from 20,000 feet as you would from 30,000 feet. But when I'm in the sky, I'm constantly thinking turbulence could start now.
What if? Yeah. The what if syndrome.
Just not, yeah, it's the not knowing, and it's the just thinking, oh, at any minute, it could be clear air turbulence.
Is it the lack of control?
For me, I think it's definitely a control thing, because I've got this book at home. It's one of the Alan Carr ones. It's his fear of flying one. And he, at the back, he's got survey results from a survey he did of people who have fear of flying. And there's a really huge correlation, something like 78% of people with fear of flying are also afraid to go on theme park rides. I've never been on a theme park ride. And there's also a really high correlation, people who are afraid to be in a car driven by other people. And it's like this long-standing joke between me and my fiance that he doesn't drive like my dad, and that the only person I'm happy being in the car with is my dad. But that is true. I do get very nervous. I get like phantom brake leg syndrome. It's incredibly annoying, but it is 100% a control thing.
What is turbulence? What's your answer to that? When people aren't sure why the plane is shaking uncontrollably,
the only way
and they
I
think
can...
that's not really a reasonable thing to happen, what do you say?
If you get on a boat, it's obviously you can feel the current of the waters, so you're bobbing along. That's basically what it is up in the air. It's just the air going around the wing, and you go through some clouds. But most people exaggerate it in their head. We've had people telling us that they've been in severe turbulence, and they haven't. They've been in very slight, when we sort of explain to them the different types of turbulence. So slight, moderate, and severe. You've probably only experienced slight, but it feels severe.
Is the plane in more danger at that point?
No. Turbulence is completely safe, and it's not dangerous at all. It's just uncomfortable, because what happens is our ears, because we're not looking out of the plane, obviously we can't really see, there's a window there, and our ears take over, which send the wrong signals. So if you keep your eyes on the horizon, out of the plane window, always sit by the window, it actually helps.
Is that, that's a good tip, is it? Or sit by the window if you're afraid
sit
of flying.
Sit by the window if you're afraid by flying.
Have you ever tried that?
Well, this is the thing, is in that, I mean, that I don't think I'm I'm halfway cured, in that I can do it, but I have to have all my rituals. Like, I have to be like next to the wing by the window, and I have to, like, you know, when we're booking our honeymoon flights, I'm like, yeah, cool, yeah. And then as soon as my fiance's asleep, I'm like, I'll just go on flight radar and check what make of plane this is, because I want to make sure it's a proper plane, like Airbus or bigger. Luckily, it is an Airbus. It hasn't been a problem. But I just feel like I've created a lot of comfortable scenario to myself, and if I ever needed to do something more adventurous, like, it would all sort of crumble.
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that. So I would say I'm a recovered flight phobic. I went on quite a lot of holidays as a kid, and for whatever reason, I guess because my parents brought me up to think of it as fun and glamorous, I wasn't bothered. And then as a teenager, I started thinking about it. And that was the problem for me, was that it wasn't an irrational fear. It was when I started rationalizing it.
Yeah.
It was when I thought, oh, actually, I am tens of thousands of feet in the air. I can't control what's going on.
No.
It's not, people say, oh, it's safer than cars.
It is.
But if you have an accident in a car, you might live. You probably won't in a plane. And I'd think all those things, and I'd think, I don't like this. And the only thing that snapped me out of it was regularity and consistency. It's when I had to start flying for work more regularly, 10, 11 times a year. And I got so used to it. Again, rituals, certain drinks knocking me out.
Yeah.
And now I'm fine. It's weird. I sort of cured myself.
I think because you were practicing and things didn't bother you after. I think that's what a lot of people, when they do come on some of our courses, who don't practice and then go on a plane sort of a year later, 2 years later, and they think, this hasn't worked for me. It's because you need to practice. So when I did the course, I think I sat there sort of during the night whilst I was still high on this adrenaline thing, and I booked about 15 flights, just cheap ones, Birmingham and back, and Amsterdam. And I made sure I just flew sort of every 2 or 3 days.
So did you fly to... Wow! So
yeah.
Of your own volition, this is before you worked for Virgin?
This is before I worked for Virgin.
This is for your own practice to get over it?
Absolutely. I thought, I've got over it. I hope it wasn't a fluke.
Did you have any setbacks? Like, did you have any bad experiences, or did you feel like you were just completely cured from then on? Nothing affected you?
No, nothing affected me. There was a little bit of turbulence. We teach a sort of trick with a water bottle. You just look at the level of the water when you think you're going through sort of severe, moderate turbulence, the water doesn't move at all, which shows there is no turbulence.
Good. That's really good.
So you just look at it, use it as a player, you know, sort of like a spirit level. It doesn't move, but in your head, it might be telling you, right, we're dropping, or we're doing this and this. And it's, again, your ears take over from your eyes. Once you know what turbulence is, it's not going to hurt you. You look at these sort of pilots that are doing the DHL deliveries. They directly fly into turbulence because they haven't got any passengers on board, just parcels. So they don't avoid it. They go straight through the clouds, through everything. They're not bothered.
But what are the technical facts you give people that liberate them a bit?
It's the pilot session. It's asking the captain for 2-3 hours. They literally grill them.
What do people get asked?
How long will it take for us to die when we fall out the sky? I think one was actually, will my underwear still be on if we fall?
Wow.
Yeah.
That's Freudian anxiety, isn't
absolutely.
It?
Absolutely.
But what are the reassuring things people get told?
I suppose it's our captains come in and they put a photo of their kids and their wife, and they said, we're actually not bothered about you, we're bothered about my children. I want to come back to see my kids and my wife.
No, I just feel like if I went along, I'd be just difficult, because I know that no one can tell me, no, there won't be turbulence, we promise, we've already seen in the future and it's not going to happen, you know. But I guess it's just getting over being afraid of it. Like, I guess there's some things where there's nothing you can say that, you know, you can't promise someone that their plane won't crash, you know.
No,
it's just that you do have to build up the mental strength to be able to get over it and put it to the back of your mind. And I think there are probably a lot of people with fear of flying who almost are afraid to start tackling it, because they know that fundamentally that's what it's about. You have to get over it. You know, there's nothing you can hear that will, you know, no one can promise you that it will definitely be okay, you know, all the time. Nothing that you're afraid of will happen.
I think what people tend to do now is that they're watching these aircraft disaster things on Discovery Channel.
Yeah.
And
they do whole weeks of those shows, don't
absolutely
they?
And they really dramatize things, you know, air pockets. There's no such thing as an air pocket.
Oh,
it doesn't
okay.
exist. The plane might, you might have a bit of clear air turbulence where your plane's sort of going along and people say, oh, if we dropped about 100 foot, everything fell. It didn't. It probably just fell 2 inches, 3 inches maximum. Nothing exciting about that at all. But it's as dramatic, you know, we like to sort of dramatise our lives a bit.
Well, I have a question. Is it true that when they tell you to brace it so they can identify you by your dental records?
No, that's a classic question. It always comes up. No, it's actually a brace position. It's supposed to protect your spine. So
identify you by your spine, or because you might live?
You might live, actually.
I find myself adopting the brace position. Tell me if this is ridiculous. On landing. Because I've seen the video at the beginning and I think, well, if that's safer, if you're hitting the ground at impact, if there's a problem at landing, that's the position I'll be in.
You do it without being asked.
Yeah, I do. I do it as we land. That's the position. I do, because other people are like reading books and turning their heads, and I think that's not a good look.
I think it's because you want to be in control. I think I still do it. I actually put my foot on the brakes. There are no brakes. So I help. I help by braking.
I also do that.
I mean, you're an adult. You know that that's a game you're playing with yourself.
Yeah, absolutely. Like, it's all games. It's so, that's what I mean. It's just like, it's so stupid. Like, I can fly, but it relies on me pretending a whole bunch of stuff and doing like stupid certain things. So like, I know that I'm not cured. I'm just like, I'm pretending.
It's little things. It's like, we have a lot of people saying, you know, there's water dripping out when we're about to take off.
Yes, I felt worried about that one.
And they get very, very sort of anxious. And when I tell them, it's just condensation. That's it from the aircon. It's so dull.
And so have you heard from people who have been in plane accidents that come on your course, or people who actually can say, no, well, that did happen to me. I was in severe turbulence. That's why I'm here.
Oh, you hear about people going, you know, the go around when you're just about to touch down landing and the plane just goes vertically.
Rebecca's nodding. Has that happened to you?
No, it hasn't, but I can picture it vividly, like everything.
Yeah. I bet you can, yeah. It's happened to me. That has happened to me.
Yeah, and this is sort of the criticism that the pilots get constantly, is you take off vertically. It doesn't, but it's good. It's at a higher
feels very
pitch.
Sudden, yeah.
Yeah, and nobody tells you what's going on.
That's right.
And it's quiet, and it's because they've just got to sort of keep it together and get the plane.
And not crash the plane.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so what do you say to people who've been in that situation? Because it happens actually in Scotland frequently. That's when it's happened.
It's
visiting
the
relatives
and things.
Yeah, in Aberdeen, places like that. And they don't know until they're very, very close to the ground that they can't see the tarmac, and then they have to take off again.
Again, it's your ears are taken over, because you think the pitch of the plane is much steeper than it really is. And when you look at it on YouTube, it's actually, again, it's dull. It's not going that steep. it's all controlled, and they're tested constantly in these sort of simulators and go through all these things. So it's for them, it's very exciting to do that. For us, it's a killer. It's I mean, that's probably one of the things that I haven't actually, I've never been through that. And I'd probably get a bit anxious myself. It's normal.
So I have a friend who works on yachts, and she has a bit of a fear of heights. And when she had to climb the mast, she'd be really panicking, shaking, like dreading doing it. And she started doing this technique that involves tapping yourself on the face. And she told me that that could also be useful for my fear of flying.
So it's sometimes known as the emotional freedom technique or thought field therapy.
Emotional freedom.
Thought field therapy. Otherwise known as tapping, and it's tapping above on certain points. There's a sort of method under your eyelid, under sort of your chest bone. You're hitting acupressure points.
Okay, so it's not complete bollocks then. There's some grounding. I mean, you know,
I'm skeptical, but I do it anyway. But you tap.
Have you tried? I mean, have you?
I've tapped away. I've given. I give the advice, but
where should I tap? So if I'm afraid of flying,
so you'd be tapping under your eyelid there.
So just on the top of the cheekbone.
On the top of the cheekbone, you'd be going on top of the eyebrow, and then you've got your collarbone, and then you tap under your near your knocker, basically. And then you have to karate chop your hands, so you're hitting all these sort of acupressure points, as you would with acupuncture.
Has that worked for people?
It has, and I've actually seen presenters on TV tapping away. You know, they're doing it discreetly, and I know what they're doing because
they're nervous. Yeah.
On a live broadcast, they're tapping away, but they're doing discreetly. And it helps people, or they're singing, and also part of this therapy, they sing Happy Birthday to you, the song, backwards and forwards. And that actually, I think, just tricks your brain. It just, it's just a bizarre sort of coping strategy. Or the elastic band, it's just a simple thing. You put it on your wrist. As soon as you think about panic or plane, you ping it really hard.
Right.
So it's to stop intrusive thoughts. But we've had people sort of pinging each other on the plane, and it's not great. And that's actually happened. It's like, oh, okay. They walk past and they're pinging. There's some bizarre therapies, but I think the best one is just get the knowledge and breathe nice and deeply. And that's it.
A lot of people do tell me, like, it won't be as bad as you think to fly long haul because you're at such a peak of panic that you can't sustain it. Like, eventually you'll tire yourself out. You can't be that panicked for, like, 10 hours.
I remember sort of one guy who was over here from New Zealand, and he was stuck on a medical visa because he couldn't get back on a plane. He just suddenly developed a plane sort of fear here. He had to sort of get in touch with the High Commission, get doctor's notes that he's anxious, he's too anxious to fly.
Wow.
Yeah.
And there really is no other way to get to New Zealand.
No, none. And he was stuck here, I think, for about 8 months. And he had kids, family over there.
Oh, my God.
He couldn't see them. There's something in him that just stopping him from getting on that plane. He tried, but he'd been off-boarded every time he tried.
Really?
Yeah.
Panic attacks?
Panic attacks and shaking. And they said, we're not taking you for sort of like 18 hours. There's absolutely no way. So he was off-boarded constantly. And he's desperate to see his wife and family.
What caused it?
He doesn't even know. I think it was turbulence and that irrational thought that he was having in moderate or severe turbulence, and in fact it wasn't. And it was that fear of, and being enclosed as well. That was a lot of work. That was a hard day. But I'm pleased to say he's back with his wife and kids.
Anna P. You can find out more about her course at flyingwithoutfear.co.uk. And by the way, you can hear more of me and Rebecca chatting away on The Week Unwrapped. That's at theweekunwrapped.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Still to come, our record of the week, and Alex Fox is up next after this.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch. Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
Now, you don't have to take your clothes off to have a good time, as I can testify, because I'm sitting here fully clothed with Alex Fox. It's the Foxhole.
Welcome to the Foxhole, Ollie, and I hope that you're having a Tuesday so good that it could win Britain's next top weekday.
What have you been up to this week?
As anyone who follows my Instagram will know, as well as finding sensual pleasure in all sorts of sex toys and gadgets and gizmos, I am a big, big fan of food. I really love posh cuisine and experimental foodstuffs and innovative recipes. So I was very chuffed this week to attend the opening of a new restaurant as part of the Ottolenghi chain, and it's called Rovi. And my mate is the chef there, Chef Neil Campbell.
This all sounds good, we're thinking, but what's it got to do with putting things up your snatch?
Well, Neil...
I'm sure there's an angle.
Neil is a big fan of using seasonal foods and also rediscovering old fruits and vegetables that were maybe quite popular in previous ancient times, but which have been forgotten about. Mm-hmm. And some of them have really rude names and connotations. Have you heard of open arse fruit?
Arse fruit? No, I haven't.
Open arse fruit?
No, I haven't, no.
It's kind of like a crab apple sort of thing. And it gets its name because it does look like someone's blasted rectum. It's not very attractive to look at, and the way you prepare it isn't particularly alluring either. You have to leave it to do something called bletting. It's basically where you leave it to go a bit off. Mm. If a fruit is particularly hard or acidic, then you leave it to go, it kind of goes mushy and brown and takes on a consistency not unlike applesauce. And lots of people throw the fruit away because they presume that it's spoiled, it's bad.
Actually, but delicious arse fruit.
Exactly. You blet your open arses and you can gobble them up. And even Shakespeare referred to open arse fruit in Romeo and Juliet.
Time for your questions of sex, sponsored by our friends at mycondom.com.
Who give away free condoms to each and every one of their account holders, and they've recently changed the freebies that they give away. You can now get up to 20 of either Skins Black Chocolate condoms, which I love because they're chocolate scented and they're black, so they've got that kind of S&M-y, bondage-y, saucy feel to them. Or you can choose some more lemon flavoured condoms. Rubber and lemon kind of give me marigold vibes. It sort of reminds me of cleaning the kitchen. But then if you're someone who's into domestic servitude and being a slave, then that might be right up your alley.
Let's take the question. It's from Chris, who says, my wife and I have been trying to conceive for the last few months. So far, no success. Occasionally, some lubricant is needed for our procreative activities, and my wife is concerned this might be affecting our chances. Currently, we've been using a water-based lubricant. Is this the best choice, or should we try something different?
Okay, Ollie, let's talk about what you can put on your PP and up your vajayjay when you're TTC, or trying to conceive.
Yes.
First up, let's address why you might need to use lubricant at all. Because a lot of people think, oh, well, if you're making a baby, why add anything to that mix? You just need a man, a woman, some sperm.
And I'm so insatiably desirable to my other half that obviously she's going to be dripping wet from the moment we walk in the threshold of the house.
Well, actually, vaginal dryness is twice as common in people who are trying to conceive as with the rest of the population.
That's fascinating.
There are a number of reasons for this. It might be because the stress of knowing that you have to bang each other in that very limited time when it's possible to conceive isn't the most alluring and seductive of scenarios. So a lot of women's bodies just... their clams clam up. They're not making the juice they need to. And also, if you're on fertility drugs, if you're taking medication to help you conceive, ironically, that can also shut down some of the systems that help you produce natural moisture.
Wow.
There are medications like Clomid, which is associated with vaginal dryness. According to one study, one in four couples reported using personal lubricants while they were trying to conceive. So lots of people are turning to the lube to help them. Unfortunately, though, standard lubes can slow sperm down, damage the DNA inside it, or even kill sperm entirely.
Wow. Okay. And, I mean, Chris mentions that they're using a water-based lubricant. Does that make any difference?
On any usual day, I would absolutely recommend water-based lubricants as a mild, inoffensive, get-on-with-most-people's-bodies kind of lube. However, they do tend to be slightly acidic, and that's not great if you're trying to conceive. A lot of standard lubricants don't have a pH that is particularly friendly towards sperm. Another thing to bear in mind is the thickness of your lube. If you're using a particularly thick lubricant, then that's going to slow your swimmers down, and you want those swimmers to vroom vroom as though they're in their bimmers. You know, you do not want them to take their time getting up to the cervix, up through that hole, and reaching their goal.
Okay, so if you were to choose a lubricant for this situation, you know, there is vaginal dryness, you want to use a lubricant, but you are trying to conceive, and that, unfortunately, romantic or not, is the purpose of this sexual encounter. Which one would you choose?
Well, for a start, avoid anything with glycerin in it, or glycerol. That's in a lot of lubricants. That can be harmful to sperm motility, so its ability to move its tail and get where it wants to go.
Sperm motility. Word of the week.
Sperm motility.
Oh, sperm motility. Not as good, but still, I've learned something.
Also, beware of anything containing non-oxanol 9. That's actually harder to get hold of in the UK, but there's still some lubricants available in the States that contain this. It's a surfactant that actually acts as a spermicide, but it's not always clearly labelled as being included in the lubricants where it is an ingredient, so watch out for that. There have been several tests on different types of lubes to try and determine which are best, because there are actually lots on the market which are specifically designed or purportedly designed to help people trying to conceive. We know that in a normal sexual encounter, the transition from semen into cervical mucus at the top of the cervix takes usually about 1.5 minutes after intercourse, and the majority of healthy sperm will make their way up into the cervix within about 15 to 20 minutes, if you're not using barrier contraception, of course. So researchers ran a little experiment where they mixed a solution, a 10% solution of various lubes, and then measured how fast sperm were moving after 0 minutes, 5 minutes, 30 minutes and 60 minutes. They found that KY jelly was one of the most harmful products that they tested when it came to sperm movement, with KY tingling reducing sperm movement to absolutely nothing. Wow. After an hour. They also looked at Pre-Seed, which is one of the conception friendly lubricants. Just under 80% of sperm was still moving after an hour, so there is a difference between these lubes.
Okay, so
they also looked at mustard oil. Apparently some people are using mustard oil as a lubricant.
Goodness. So you've told us what not to look for, but can you go far enough to say this is the one to look for? This is the sort of lubricant you should be using?
I wouldn't want to endorse a particular lubricant myself, because although some tests have been done, they haven't been entirely comprehensive and not all of them have been independent. But I've spoken to a couple of brands and got them to tell me what's good about what they produce. I spoke to Slickquid, who produce a pro-conception lubricant, and they told me that theirs is different because the normal vaginal pH usually has a range of between 3.5 and 4.5. But when a woman ovulates, the pH of the vagina actually becomes more alkaline. It gets higher. This is because the pH of sperm is usually between about 7.1 to 8. So the woman's body tries to create temporarily a more hospitable environment for the sperm to be able to thrive. To complement that, the pro-conception lube that Slickquid make is also around a pH of 7.2, so it's got a different pH to your standard water-based lubricants. I spoke to Yes, who make organic lubricants. They're actually certified by the Soil Association, which is useful if you're trying to have a baby, because you're going to get soiled a lot in 9 months' time when hopefully one arrives. They take things a little bit further. For a start, they've also matched the pH of their lubricant to the pH of sperm and to the changing pH of the cervix during the ovulation period, but they have package this lubricant in an applicator tube that you can insert up your vaginal canal and squirt it directly onto the cervix so it gets where it's needed faster. And they've produced a second product, a vaginal moisturiser, designed to return the body to the normal pH afterwards. That can help prevent irritation that they say might lead to things like thrush or other infections or aggravation, which can actually make a woman's body a less easy place for a child to grow.
Thank you. If you have a question for Alex for next week's Foxhole, what should you do with it?
What you want to do is go to our website, modernmanwith2ends.co.uk, and hit feedback.
And if you aren't intending to conceive and you want to make sure that none of your cum goes anywhere apart from back down onto your own penis, where should you go?
You want to go to mycondom.com, and you definitely want to use the code FOXHOLE, which will get you 15% off everything on the site.
Well, that is nearly it for this week's show, but there is just time to anoint a new ambassador. It's Laura in Kyoto, Japan, who says, I discovered the show after a fellow lifeboat crew member recommended it. I'm a photographer and listen to your show with my boyfriend whilst editing my images. I love hearing everyone's interesting stories, and I'm just about to buy you a couple of beers to say thanks. That swung it, Laura. Consider yourself ambassador for Kyoto. Congratulations. And if you would like to donate to the show and support our independent podcast, just visit modernmanwith2ends.co.uk and click Beer Money. Music now, and our theme is by Django Django from their self-titled debut album. They're gigging in France this week. And speaking of France, our record of the week is by Polo Epan, and it's called Arc-en-Ciel, or Rainbow. It's out now on Universal. I've been Ollie Mann, the producer, Matt Hill, and we'll see you next Tuesday.
So, retrospectors, what historical events are we ticking off on this week's run of Today in History?
Well, on Monday, it's the anniversary of the table knife being invented.
On Tuesday, we explain how the tradition of the two-minute silence originated in Cape Town.
On Wednesday, we recall the day King George III proved he was assassin-proof.
On Thursday, let's all eat cake. It's Marie Antoinette's wedding.
And on Friday, we discover how Buffalo Bill helped invent the Wild West.
We discuss this and more on Today in History with the Retrospectors. 10 minutes each weekday, wherever you get your podcasts.